Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A warning for listeners. Throughout this podcast, we have original audio from 9/11, plus recreations of that day. We feel it is important for listeners to hear, but it can also be disturbing. President George W. Bush spent much of the morning of September 11, 2001, aboard Air Force One, flying far above the chaos. A White House stenographer aboard the plane later recalled looking out at the eerie scene in the cabin, the small group of hushed passengers trying to figure out where they were headed next, as anxious Secret Service agents tried to get the latest intelligence on the attacks. After air traffic controllers shut down the U.S. airspace, one agent remarked that Air Force One was the only plane in the sky. That's what I called my book, An Oral History on 9/11, The Only Plane in the Sky. But that statement isn't exactly true. For one thing, there were a bunch of military planes accompanying Air Force One across the country that day. There were other fighter jets out on combat air patrols over major cities like New York, Boston, and Washington, D.C., and military cargo planes raced to the crash sites with rescuers, investigators, and supplies. But there's another secretive flight that's raised suspicions for decades. People often come up to me at events and whisper, or even interrupt public Q&A sessions to say something like this. We all know that Air Force One wasn't the only plane in the sky. The U.S. snuck Bin Laden's family out of the country that day to help the Saudi government. As paranoid as that may sound, it's sort of true. The U.S. and Saudi governments have been close allies for decades. They've bonded over a mutual hatred of communism and a love of Saudi oil. Just 2 days after 9/11, the powerful Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, went to the White House. There, he relaxed on the Truman balcony with President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. A rare photo of the meeting shows Bandar appearing to smoke a cigar. We don't know what was discussed there, but we do know that just a few days later, special charter flights began ferrying prominent Saudis out of the U.S. The Bin Ladens were a prominent Saudi family. Osama's wealth came from the family construction empire, which was responsible for many of the biggest infrastructure projects across the Middle East, including rebuilding the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. On 9/11 itself, one of Osama's half-brothers, Shafiq Bin Laden, was a guest of honor at a fancy conference in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the Carlyle Group, an international global investment firm. Other relatives were in the country at the time, too. After the attacks, one frantically called the Saudi embassy in Washington. They needed to leave now. CBS News reported that they thought that they might be lynched. So a total of 13 other members of the Bin Laden family, plus their bodyguards and associates, were snuck out of the U.S. on a special chartered Boeing 727. That was on September 19th. So it's true that they were snuck out of the country, but not on the day of the attacks. Nevertheless, the existence of the Bin Laden escape remained an unconfirmed rumor until 2004, when the flight manifest was finally released. It was just one of six special charter flights that left the U.S. within 2 weeks of the attack. Most of the nearly 150 total passengers aboard those planes were Saudis. The FBI said that all the passengers were specially screened and the government was confident that none of them should be detained before they left. And yet the reason that the original Bin Laden family flight continues to raise so many questions is because it's part of one of the biggest remaining mysteries of 9/11. There are Saudi fingerprints all over the 9/11 attacks, including some from government officials. So did the Saudi government know about the attacks? Or even worse, did they help the hijackers? 9/11 Commission member Jamie Gorelick.
Attackers who came to the United States, after all, from other places, had to get into the United States, had to travel here, had to be met at the airport, had to be housed, had to be trained. This was complicated. And the notion that they could have done this without any organized help was preposterous.
I'm Garrett Graff, a journalist, historian, and the author of The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11. And I've spent much of the last two decades studying and reporting on September 11th and how it changed our world. But as we face the 20th anniversary of the attacks, it's clear that many people still don't know the full story. From Longlead and Goat Rodeo, this is Long Shadow, a podcast about the enduring mysteries and lingering questions of 9/11. Episode 7, How Secret Flights and Wealthy, Well-Connected Diplomats Raise Questions That Four Consecutive Presidential Administrations Won't Answer. What is the Saudi connection to 9/11? For 20 years, federal officials have dodged these questions. Saudi Arabia is one of the most important allies to the United States in the Middle East, a partnership forged in oil and regional geopolitics. So even though the two countries may publicly disagree on issues like human rights, to many, the relationship with Saudi Arabia is, to steal a financial phrase, too big to fail.
And the Saudis spent a lot of money in Washington, D.C., and a lot of weapons purchased in our military-industrial complex. And they enjoy special status because they're a counterweight and anti-Iran, which is, you know, one of our mortal enemies, so to speak, in the Middle East. And they are quietly friendly to Israel.
That's Andrew Maloney. He represents a big group of the families of 9/11 victims who are currently in the middle of suing the Saudi government. I'll tell you more about that case in a few minutes. Because of these connections, he says three presidents have stonewalled their efforts to get to the truth.
Now, perhaps at some point in time down the road, after the investigations are fully complete, if it doesn't jeopardize our national security, perhaps we can...
Sometimes we have to balance our need to speak to them about human rights issues with immediate concerns that we have in terms of countering terrorism or dealing with regional stability.
They're buying hundreds of billions of dollars worth of things from this country. If I say we don't want to take your business, if I say we're going to cut it off, they will get the equipment, military equipment and other things from Russia and China.
But the connection between the hijackers on 9/11 and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia became immediately evident after the attacks. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi, as was Osama bin Laden.
He was the 17th of more than 50 children of a self-made billionaire. Most of his brothers were educated abroad, but Osama stayed in Saudi Arabia.
Osama was more religious than the rest of us. He did not like to listen to music or to watch TV.
He was an extremist from a young age. Osama followed a specific strain of Islam that's tightly coiled with the Saudi government itself. Wahhabism is a conservative branch of the religion that underlies much of Islamic extremism, a movement founded in what eventually became Saudi Arabia. The Saudi royal family took power in part by courting scholars and clerics that practice Wahhabism, and now the two are inextricably linked. But in the hours and days after 9/11, the questions about Saudi ties to the attacks went far beyond the hijackers themselves. While the bin Ladens escaped the country by plane, there were also suspicious reports about other well-connected Saudis in the U.S. Had others known an attack was coming? The first was a family in Florida, a couple and two kids. The woman was the daughter of a Saudi entrepreneur and consultant to the royal family. She and her family had lived in a gated Sarasota neighborhood for 6 years. Right up until August 2001. That's when a neighbor reportedly saw them hop into a white van and drive off.
An FBI investigation showed that in the weeks leading up to that, the vehicles used by the hijackers while they trained in Venice made several stops at the home. There are also phone calls linking the family staying there to the hijackers, including leader Mohammed Atta.
Soon the neighborhood was full of FBI agents sifting through every inch of the house. The family's fridge was still full, the pool still running. An FBI analyst noted that they left behind valuable items like clothing and jewelry. But their safe was unlocked and empty. Reporters eventually reached the father. He said his family left because of his new job and called the 9/11 attacks a crime against the U.S. and all humankind. But that's basically all we know about the Sarasota family. The FBI has an 80,000-page report on them, but you and I have never seen it. For years, the Bureau has successfully fought to keep it secret, saying its release would jeopardize national security. And even the 9/11 Commission made no mention of the Sarasota family. The investigation also didn't show up in a later report to Congress, because the FBI never told them. I've covered the FBI for more than a decade, and in case it's not obvious, they don't end up with a file of 80,000 pages without a lot more than just random coincidences. Attorney Andrew Maloney again.
I think there were a lot of field agents that were trying to do the right thing, and they were stymied. They were literally told, don't look there. Don't look over there. Look in that direction. Don't look in that direction. They were literally told things like that. So you had field agents that were doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing, but then you had the supervisors or the political people at FBI or above FBI at DOJ or the White House saying, don't look over there. They didn't want to know the answers.
The Sarasota family set up a pattern we'd see over and over again in the years after 9/11. Questions come up, the FBI investigates, and the answers are buried. Before the attacks, the feds didn't think much about Saudi intelligence inside the United States. They were our ally. But after 9/11, that changed. A joint squad from the Washington field office began a rush investigation, and they didn't like what they found. In 2003 and 2004, the U.S. revoked dozens of Saudi diplomatic visas, expelling a cohort of Saudi government officials who were running an Islamic program that U.S. officials believed fostered extremism. It underscored the larger concern inside the administration in the wake of the attacks. Was there a Saudi support network in the U.S.? And did they help the hijackers carry out the attacks? Federal officials conducted hundreds of interviews and spent millions of dollars trying to figure it out. At first glance, the 9/11 Commission seemed to arrive at a straightforward conclusion. Quote, the Commission staff found no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or as individual senior officials knowingly support or supported al-Qaeda. But anyone who's familiar with government speak sees that there's a lot of wiggle room in that answer. As an institution? Senior officials? Well, what about parts of the Saudi government? Or even mid-level officials?
There is and remains a murkiness there that we didn't entirely clarify.
That's Jamie Gorelick, a member of the 9/11 Commission.
The Saudi government, but more importantly, individuals within the Saudi power structure, funded many of the groups whose actions were behind the attack.
Gorelick says it's hard to tell if the Saudi government took part or if it was just individuals around the government acting on their own.
There also were loose ends that we identify in the 9/11 Commission report, places where the trail ran dry. It's hard to know what the people who helped the hijackers actually knew. This is just not something we were able to determine. Most of the people we were able to interview denied knowledge that they might well have had or not. I think people knew more than they acknowledged. This was a massive operation. You think about what was required to pull this off. It was astounding. The notion that someone sitting in Afghanistan or Germany could mass 20-odd people to take over planes, kill pilots, get box cutters through security, learn how to fly, do all the things that they had to do. Oh, my God. It is astounding. And I just don't think you do that without help. I find it very hard to believe.
One of the dead ends the 9/11 Commission may have come across is the dense and complicated process of funding terror. There have been long-standing accusations that al-Qaeda gets money through Saudi Arabia. A declassified CIA and FBI document said that al-Qaeda sympathizers had infiltrated and exploited the Saudi government. That goes back to the relationship between the Saudi government and radical Islam. The royal family, the country's governing body, gives out huge sums of money to Muslim clerics, imams, and charities to promote the religion around the world. Money that often supports Wahhabist teachings. Here's attorney Andrew Maloney again.
The royal family would fund anything that the imams wanted around the world. And that's where the trouble begins, because what the royal family and people in government knew was that there were religious zealots that were radicals. When the hijackers arrived, they already had a network of supporters within the government and also non-government worshipers at the local mosques where you had, you know, anti-American rhetoric being proselytized for many years.
Another congressional inquiry investigated the 9/11 attacks and released their own report in 2002. But it had a mysterious final chapter on the Saudi connection. The title was ambiguous. Quote, finding discussion and narrative regarding certain sensitive national security matters. It's such a vague collection of words that it could have meant anything. But the section's 28 pages remained classified for years. While public pressure mounted for them to be released, questions about Saudi links put the kingdom's diplomats and the White House on edge. Here's a former Saudi foreign minister.
It is an outrage to any sense of fairness that 28 blank pages are now considered substantial evidence to proclaim the guilt of a country that has been a true friend and partner to the United States for over 60 years.
Finally, in 2016, the pages were partially declassified. Its first two sentences are stark. Quote, finding. While in the United States, some of the September 11 hijackers were in contact with and received support or assistance from individuals who may be connected to the Saudi government. End quote. The inquiry pointed to a man named Omar al-Bayoumi. The FBI determined that he lived in the United States in 2001 and was likely tied to Saudi intelligence. Bayoumi worked on and off for a government contractor. He had been paid directly by the family of the powerful Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar. According to Bayoumi, he had befriended two of the would-be hijackers before the attacks. The trio met in early 2000 in Los Angeles. Bayoumi helped them settle into the United States. The hijackers spoke little English and had spent almost no time in the West, so they desperately needed help navigating this foreign land. Bayoumi helped them find an apartment and even co-signed their lease. He helped get them driver's licenses and gathered information about flight schools. Then, around the time the hijackers arrived in the U.S., Bayoumi phoned a Northern Virginia imam, Anwar al-Awlaki. Investigators later found that he had served as the hijackers' spiritual advisor in the United States. His own role in the 9/11 attacks has always been murky. He would go on to become one of the most important leaders of the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen. And Anwar al-Awlaki would ultimately be killed in a U.S. drone strike in 2011, the first U.S. citizen ever targeted and killed by its own government.
Don't consult with anybody in the killing of Americans. Fighting the devil doesn't require consultation or prayers seeking divine guidance. They are the party of the devils.
10 days after 9/11, The FBI tracked Omar al-Bayoumi down in the UK, where he was then running a Saudi student association. He told them almost nothing useful and swore he just happened to befriend the two men after running into them in a restaurant. The fact that his government stipend quadrupled right around the time he helped the would-be hijacker settle into San Diego? Just another coincidence, he said. The FBI went so far as to open a full investigation into the Saudi connection, known as Operation Encore. In 2007, investigators finally sorted through Bayoumi's sealed personal items and found something remarkable. In his backpack was a drawing. It showed how a plane would spiral down to hit a target on the ground. It looked like the path his friends, the two hijackers, would later take when American Airlines Flight 77 hit the Pentagon on 9/11. Even with all this circumstantial evidence against Bayoumi, it never cleanly fit together. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind behind the attacks, said he didn't know Bayoumi when he was interrogated at Guantanamo Bay. So with no clear link between Bayoumi and the plot or Al-Qaeda, investigators released him and he returned to the kingdom. Here's al-Bayoumi later speaking to a state-run Saudi news outlet.
The Saudi investigators also investigated me. They didn't find any evidence to connect me to this.
Still, the potential Saudi connection to 9/11 continues to perplex. So the victims' families started putting pressure on their own government. Countries are under a legal protection called sovereign immunity. At a very basic level, that means that under normal circumstances, people, individuals, can't just sue a foreign government in the U.S. court. In a way, it's sort of the whole point of being a country. You can't be held accountable to another country's laws. That meant that the 9/11 victims' families could not bring a civil lawsuit against the Saudi government or its officials in U.S. federal court. It also meant that they couldn't pry loose any information beyond what the U.S. government was willing to share. But the Saudi government didn't anticipate one thing: the political power and the potency of those families. For a decade, they showed up at speeches, court hearings, and press conferences pushing for one thing: justice. Here's Terry Strada, whose husband Tom died in the Twin Towers, talking to Megyn Kelly on Fox News.
Terry, obviously you lost your husband in 9/11, and you go forward with this, but why would you want to sue Saudi Arabia, given the difficulty that would be associated with it, given the unlikelihood of actually collecting on any judgment you might get?
Oh, because the evidence points to them, so they are the ones responsible for the murder of my husband, and I, like all the other 9/11 families, we deserve justice and accountability for that. Our lives were shattered on that day, and it has not been easy the last 15 years, and it's never going to be easy living without him. So there needs to be accountability. It doesn't matter what country it was.
Their public demand for accountability worked. It led to Congress almost unanimously passing what was known as the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or JASTA, in 2016. Attorney Andrew Maloney, who represents the victims' families.
They amended the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act essentially to say any state or country that sponsors or conspires or aids or abets international terrorists to attack Americans on U.S. soil, just in our homeland, can be held accountable in a U.S. courtroom.
Everyone knew that the generically written bill was truly aimed at Saudi Arabia. But President Barack Obama feared a diplomatic tussle with the kingdom and the chance that they might retaliate economically, so he vetoed it. But Congress easily overrode him.
Sometimes you have to do what's hard. And frankly, I wish Congress here had done what's hard. I didn't expect it, because voting, if you're perceived as voting against 9/11 families right before an election, not surprisingly, that's a hard vote for people to take. But it would have been the right thing to do.
That meant that a massive, multi-thousand plaintiff lawsuit against Saudi Arabia moved forward in U.S. courts. The lawsuit alleges that the Saudi government knowingly supported Al-Qaeda and facilitated the September 11th attacks. It will be years before this case gets anywhere close to a conclusion, but even in its early stages, it's revealed some troubling new details. Documents filed in the lawsuit allege that the Saudi government may have even funded a dry run of the 9/11 attacks 2 years earlier. That was when two Saudi students boarded an American West flight from Phoenix to Washington. Aboard the plane, in flight, the two men reportedly asked technical questions about how to fly it. They apparently even tried to enter the cockpit, saying that they were confused about the location of the bathroom. The pilot, worried, made an emergency landing in Ohio, where the two were handcuffed and questioned by police. During the lawsuit, it was revealed that both men got financial support from the Saudi government.
The report alleges the embassy paid for two Saudi nationals to fly from Phoenix to Washington 2 years before the attacks took place. FBI documents submitted as evidence claimed that the two Saudi nationals who came to the U.S. were in fact members of the kingdom's network of agents in the country.
Both had also allegedly trained at Al-Qaeda camps alongside the 9/11 hijackers and had contact with them while in the United States. One of the men on the Phoenix flight reportedly even tried to re-enter the country in the summer of 2001, but was turned away. The FBI declined to press charges at the time. The U.S. government has continued to fight the family's lawsuit and refuses to release information about the Saudi ties to 9/11. We learned a little bit more last year by accident. The 9/11 families had finally had an audience with then-President Donald Trump. Here's their attorney, Andrew Maloney, again.
I think the president wanted a photo op. The president promised that he was going to declassify the 9/11 material and give it to the families. That's why they went to the White House. That's what they were asking for.
But Attorney General Bill Barr quickly backed off that pledge, arguing in court that any further disclosures would spill state secrets. Then the Justice Department made a paperwork error. In a court filing, the FBI overlooked a single mention of a Saudi official's name and failed to redact it. It became public that a Saudi embassy official in Washington helped some of the hijackers settle into the U.S. in 2001. Again, it's not clear whether he understood he was helping Al-Qaeda operatives or if he was just being a gracious Saudi host. But why, after so long, had the FBI and the Justice Department still tried to keep that identity a state secret? And what else are they still hiding? Today, the Saudi-U.S. relationship is frayed, especially following the kingdom's kidnapping and killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Now, President Joe Biden faces his own pressure to come clean about the U.S. government's knowledge about those Saudi ties to 9/11. So in August, ahead of the 20th anniversary, the families of the 9/11 victims told Biden to stay away from their memorial services. They told him he's not welcome until his administration releases more information about the Saudi connection. Their lawyer, Andrew Maloney, again.
So the families are angry. And it's not just President Biden, it's three administrations. And they are livid that yet another anniversary is going to come and go. And the 20th anniversary is a pretty big milestone. And so they said, we don't want you there unless you're going to stand with us. And that means declassify the material so we can use it in our lawsuit to get the Saudis.
The pressure seems to have worked. This September, President Biden signed a new executive order. It requires the FBI and other agencies to determine what additional documents they can declassify related to the attacks, and particularly the Saudi role therein. In the days, weeks, and months ahead, maybe we'll learn the truth. Now, Biden plans to visit the three sites of the attacks on their 20th anniversary. Next time on Long Shadow, we're going to tell the most amazing 9/11 story I've ever encountered. You'll hear from two survivors buried in the rubble of the World Trade Center when it collapsed. They'll tell us what it's like to have skyscrapers fall on top of you and how after you stand back up.
Under the most extreme conditions you could possibly imagine, they were still functioning. They were still trying to save people's lives. And that's what I remember as the 20th anniversary approaches.
Long Shadow is a production from Goat Rodeo and Longlead. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Go ahead and rate the show and leave us a review. It helps spread the word. I'm your host, Garrett Graff. Long Shadow's lead producer is Max Johnston. John Patrick Pullen is the show's executive producer. The episode was written by me and Max. Story editing from Morgan Springer. Editorial support from Dan Eisner, Diana Elbasha, and Owen O'Carroll. Senior producers at Goat Rodeo are Megan Nadolsky and Ian Enright. Rebecca Seidel is managing producer. Production assistance on this episode from Isabel Kirby McGowan. Music from Blue Dot Sessions and Ian Enright. Podcast artwork by Emily Crawford. Longlead's creative director is Natalie Matuszewski. And a thanks to ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, C-SPAN, and the 9/11 Memorial and Museum for some of the archival audio you hear on the show.